Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 23rd Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. AP NORC poll on war in Ukraine. Results show opinion is split. About half in U.S. think government giving too much in support of Kyiv, by Seung-Min Kim and Lindley Sanders. Denver, group calls for activists to disrupt Israel event. Global Conference for Israel set to begin November 30th, by John Aguilar. Lakewood, Moose and Luke, an unlikely running duo. Officer, student with cerebral palsy, began friendship that lasted until Luke's death, by John Mayer. Rainbow Bridge border crossing. No terrorism in car crash and explosion, New York governor says, by Carolyn Thompson and Jennifer Peltz, and following up with miscellaneous articles. AP NORC poll on war in Ukraine. Results show opinion is split. About half in U.S. think government giving too much in support of Kyiv, by Seung-Min Kim and Lindley Sanders, the Associated Press, Washington. As lawmakers in Washington weigh sending billions more in federal support to Kyiv to help fight off Russian aggression, close to half of the U.S. public thinks the country is spending too much on aid to Ukraine, according to polling from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Those sentiments, driven primarily by Republicans, help explain the hardening opposition among conservative GOP lawmakers on Capitol Hill who are rebuffing efforts from President Joe Biden to approve a new tranche of Ukraine aid, arguing that the money would be better spent for domestic priorities. Yet opposition to aid is down slightly from where it was a month ago in another AP NORC poll. Now 45% say the U.S. government is spending too much on aid to Ukraine in the war against Russia, compared with 52% in October. That shift appears to come mostly from Republicans. 59% now say too much is spent on Ukraine aid, but that's down from 69% in October. Nonetheless, the Republican resistance to continued Ukraine aid remains strong. I understand the citizens need help, but I feel like we're spending way too much money on Ukraine when we have our issues here on our own soil that we need to deal with, said Eric Mondello, 40, from Fountain, pointing to needs such as health care for veterans and homelessness in communities. Mondello said, I understand the U.S. has been an ally to others, but I feel like let's take care of our people first. More than one-third, 38% of U.S. adults say that current spending is about the right amount, which is up slightly from last month, 31%. Among Republicans, nearly 3 in 10, 29%, say the current spending is about right, up from 20% last month. Paula Graves, 69, is among those who says the amount of spending for Ukraine is the right amount. Putin, he's straight up evil. I don't think there should be any question in anyone's mind, said Graves of Clovis, California. He's a dictator. He's infringed on human rights. He's a very scary person, and if Ukraine falls to him, who's next? What country's next? Graves, who says she is not affiliated with a political party but leans more conservative, said she believes the U.S. has a leadership role on the global stage and added, I think we definitely need to put America first, but I don't think that needs to be first and only. The White House has been pressing lawmakers repeatedly to pass Biden's nearly $106 billion emergency spending package that he proposed in October, which includes more than $61 billion specifically for the war in Ukraine. The rest of Biden's request has aid for Israel as it battles Hamas, money for various priorities in the Indo-Pacific region, and additional resources to help manage migration at the southern border. On Ukraine, the Biden administration is increasingly warning that the well of aid is running dry. In an unannounced visit to Kyiv on Monday, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Ukraine's effort to defeat Russian forces matters to the rest of the world and pledged that U.S. support would continue for the long haul. That message was reinforced at the White House. As President Biden has said, when aggressors don't pay a price for their aggression, they'll cause more chaos and death and destruction. John Kirby, spokesman for the National Security Council, told the White House news briefing Monday. They just keep on going, and the cost and the threats to America and to the world will keep rising. But Congress has rebuffed the White House efforts at bolstering Ukraine support at least twice in recent months. First, it ignored a $40 billion supplemental request before a September 30th funding deadline. Then last week, it passed a stopgap funding measure that keeps the government operating through early next year, but with no additional Ukraine aid. In the Senate, a small bipartisan group is working on legislation that would combine fresh Ukraine assistance with stricter border measures to address concerns from Republicans that the U.S. was focused on needs abroad at the expense of issues closer to home. A broad majority of senators remain supportive of Ukraine aid, with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, being one of the most stalwart supporters despite the isolationist strain in his party. South Dakota Senator John Thune, the number two Republican in the Senate, said lawmakers will continue to work on the Ukraine border package over the Thanksgiving break and won't wait until mid-January, when Congress faces another government funding deadline to act on Ukraine. The big question mark is in the House, where still new Speaker Mike Johnson, who had voted against Ukraine aid as a rank-and-file conservative, has spoken broadly of the need to counter Russian aggression, yet faces unruly GOP lawmakers who have shown more hostility to continued support for Kyiv. Johnson, too, is insisting that additional Ukraine aid be paired with tougher border measures, although it is far from certain that any immigration agreement that clears the Democratic-led Senate could pass the GOP-controlled House. Denver. Group calls for activists to disrupt Israel event. Global Conference for Israel, set to begin November 30th, by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. A pro-Palestinian group is calling for activists to shut down next week's Global Conference for Israel, a four-day gathering in Denver of prominent Jewish leaders and supporters of Israel. The annual conference has become the latest focal point of reaction locally to Israel's war in the Gaza Strip, which it launched in response to Hamas's deadly October 7th terrorist attack on Israeli soil. The conference, organized by the Jewish National Fund USA, is set to begin November 30th at the Colorado Convention Center. Governor Jared Polis, who is Jewish, is scheduled to speak at the event on its opening night. The Denver Police Department said Wednesday it was working with the organizers to ensure a safe event. As a precaution, the department will be providing additional resources to enhance security surrounding the conference, DPD's statement read. We will not share specific numbers or planning strategies for safety reasons. The Global Conference for Israel is expected to attract about 2,500 people to downtown Denver. It is the 22nd annual gathering, according to Sam Goldberg, president of the Jewish National Fund USA Mountain States Board. Last year's conference was in Boston. Pro-Palestinian activists have organized recurring events in Denver, maintaining a presence that included interrupting the legislature's special session on property taxes during the weekend. On the Colorado Palestine Coalition's Instagram account, the organization declares that Zionists, racists, and genocide apologists are not welcome in Denver, referencing next week's conference. In a November 13th post, it called for the shutdown, but exactly what an attempted shutdown would look like is unclear. Abdullah Alaga, an organizer for the Colorado Palestine Coalition, told the Denver Post in an interview Wednesday that he was not sure exactly what we will be doing during the conference. He's critical of the Jewish National Fund USA, saying the organization, which describes itself on its website as Your Voice in Israel, has had a direct hand in the brutalization of Palestinians for decades. He pointed to the war in Gaza as well as the ongoing building of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, which the United Nations has found violates the Fourth Geneva Convention, as concerns. The State of Israel or any of its affiliated organizations should not be fundraising in our state in the middle of a genocide, Alaga said, referring to the more than 12,700 Palestinians who have been killed since the war in Gaza began in early October. That figure has been released by the Palestinian health authorities. Israel began launching airstrikes and later ground incursions in Gaza after Hamas terrorists brutally slaughtered more than 1,200 Israelis and took more than 200 people hostage in the October 7th raid. Israel declared war on Hamas, which has been designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, and the European Union. Israel and Hamas agreed to a temporary ceasefire agreement, announced Wednesday. That's intended to allow for the release of dozens of hostages taken during Hamas's raid. The conference in Denver was planned well before the latest hostilities, but the escalations will have an unavoidable impact. Goldberg from the Jewish National Fund USA Mountain States Board discussed his outlook. Hamas will not be forgiven for its intentional murder of babies and the brutal rape and mutilation of women, he said. All of the hostages that remain in Gaza must be freed immediately, especially the little kids. At the same time, there are certainly reasonable and thoughtful critiques of Israel to be had, Goldberg said, and many of them will be voiced at the conference. But those who support Israel's destruction, he said, are unwelcome. Alaga's interest in the war is personal. He was among Palestinian Americans who recently recounted to the Post how their families in Gaza have been affected by the war. Alaga's family has lost more than 30 members to Israeli airstrikes since the war began last month, he said. A spokesman, Connor Cahill, told the Post this week that the governor intends to deliver remarks at the conference as planned. Polis, Cahill said, strongly believes that Israel has a right to defend its citizens against Hamas and to respond to the brutal murder of hundreds of Israeli citizens and to work to facilitate the return of hundreds of hostages. Lakewood, Moose and Luke, an unlikely running duo. Officer, student with cerebral palsy, began friendship that lasted until Luke's death. By John Meyer, The Denver Post. Gretchen Olmsted said she remembers the phone call as if it happened yesterday. Jesus Moose Chavez, the school resource officer assigned by the Lakewood Police Department to Alameda International High School, was calling to say he had met her son, Luke, at a Special Olympics event at Jefferson County Stadium. Luke was born with cerebral palsy, confined to a wheelchair, and nonverbal, but Chavez sensed an opportunity to bring him joy. He called me out of the blue, Olmsted said recently, 2 months after her son passed away at age 26 because of medical complications related to his cerebral palsy. He said, I watched Luke and I saw how much joy he had with someone pushing him fast on the track. I'm a runner and it got me thinking, how fun would it be to push him in a race? I'm just calling to ask your permission. Would you give us the blessing of doing a race together? Are you kidding? She replied. We would love to do that. Thus began a relationship that enriched Luke's life throughout his 4 years at Alameda and the 8 years that followed, until he passed away on August 31st. At a celebration of life held in Golden Gate Canyon State Park, Lakewood Police Commander Randy McNitt described the bond between Luke and Chavez as a bromance. Luke and Chavez did a half dozen races together, most of them half marathons. Chavez worked with the school's athletic department to have Luke awarded a letter in track and field, which he received at a school assembly in his honor. The student body gave him a standing ovation. We've worked really hard together, Chavez said the day Luke received his letter. I know that sounds a little weird, but as much as I push him, he pushes me. Chavez also pushed Luke in his wheelchair at his graduation ceremony in 2015. When we put him in Alameda High School, I wanted him to be around typical kids, but I was a little concerned about his safety because sometimes kids can be extremely cruel, said Luke's father, Mark. Moose being there definitely helped that. He probably facilitated all the other kids embracing Luke. I think he helped build that link for all those kids to see Luke as a person. Chavez, who is in his 15th year as an SRO at Alameda, says he can't find adequate words to describe the depth of his relationship with Luke. When we were together, you could tell he was happy, Chavez said. He couldn't talk, but he would make this awesome sound that just made you feel so good. It just got to your heart like, wow, I actually did something. I will never know if he was truly happy with me running or just happy that I paid attention to him. People like Luke, special needs students, are always forgotten, or people are afraid to interact with them because they don't know how. They're the forgotten class students. On race days, Luke was always raring to go. He was wired, Gretchen said. He loved it. I think it was about all the people, being around all that energy, being with Moose, being partners in the race with Moose. Gretchen hopes Alameda grads who saw the devotion Chavez had for Luke when they were classmates will remember it now, at a time when the presence of armed school resource officers has become controversial to some school districts, such as Denver's. He went above and beyond, trying to keep Luke included, Olmsted said. Moose always saw the possibility, not the disability, with Luke, and it inspired us. Chavez is saddened by the negative connotations some apply to SROs, saying he spends more time advocating and standing up for students than arresting them. Arresting is easy, Chavez said last month in his office at Alameda. I'm not just here to arrest you. I'm here to help you. If you read or watch the news, we're all black hearts and robots, and we're taking kids to prison more than we are to graduation. My thought is that I fail kids if I don't help them get to graduation. Without that simple piece of paper from high school, I know they're going to suffer because I have family members who suffered, not having that little piece of paper. I hope and I push kids to be better. Luke was born at 27 weeks, Gretchen said, fighting for his life. He spent 8 weeks in the neonatal ICU at Lutheran Hospital before coming home. Despite his struggles and limitations, he grew up with personality and spirit. He was nonverbal, but man, could he tell you a lot just with his eyes and his facial expressions, Gretchen said. We used to call him Happy-Go-Lucky because he was just so smiley, happy in the moment. His name translates to light, so we named him very appropriately. A lot of people said Luke lit up the room. He would laugh at you, like if we got upset or frustrated, he would just giggle. He was such a teacher for us. We knew he was on loan to us. We also knew that more than likely, we were going to outlive him. Luke had 2 major hospital stays prior to the 3rd one this year that preceded his death. The first one in 2018 nearly cost him his life. Chavez spent a night with him during that stay so his parents could go home and get a good night's sleep. There was another long hospital stay in 2020 during the pandemic. His final hospital stay began August 6th. Experiencing serious lung and bowel problems, Luke was discharged to a hospice facility August 31st. His parents planned to bring him home, but the doctor advised against that. Gretchen said Luke came undone when they put him on the gurney for transport because he sensed something was wrong. He was a brave kid, Gretchen said, but he fell apart when he realized that we were not taking him home. An hour and 12 minutes after arriving at the hospice facility, Luke died in his mother's arms. I'm so sad to see him gone, said his father, but the suffering is over, and I am so thankful I had those 26 years with him. It was absolutely the best gift of my life. Rainbow Bridge Border Crossing. No Terrorism in Car Crash and Explosion, New York Governor says, by Carolyn Thompson and Jennifer Peltz, the Associated Press, Niagara Falls, New York. A vehicle speeding toward a U.S.-Canada bridge from the American side crashed and exploded at a checkpoint in Niagara Falls on Wednesday, killing 2 people and prompting the closing of border crossings in the area, authorities said. Governor Kathy Hochul said there was no indication of a terrorist attack. Much remained unclear about the crash, which investigators were working to understand. Hochul said it wasn't clear whether the driver was intentionally heading for the Rainbow Bridge across the Niagara River when the vehicle hit a median and flew into the air. Based on what we know at this moment, she said, there was no sign of terrorist activity in this crash. It prompted the closing of four border crossings and raised concerns on both sides of the border. The White House said President Joe Biden was closely following developments, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said officials were taking this extraordinarily seriously. This is obviously a very serious situation in Niagara Falls, Trudeau said in Parliament before excusing himself from question period in the House of Commons to be briefed further. The two deceased people were in the vehicle, a law enforcement official told the Associated Press. The official was not authorized to discuss details of the investigation publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. Aaron Ferguson, a spokesperson for the city of Niagara Falls, said the vehicle was traveling at high speed from that city and crashed into the border station. Tim Diodati, the mayor of Niagara Falls, Ontario, told the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation that what happened appeared to be an isolated incident. The FBI's field office in Buffalo and other agencies were investigating the blast. Photos and video taken by bystanders and posted on social media showed thick smoke, flames on the pavement, and a security booth that had been singed. Videos showed that the fire was in a U.S. Customs and Border Protection area just east of the main vehicle checkpoint. The agency had no immediate comment. Speaking to WGRZ-TV, witness Mike Gunther said he saw a vehicle speeding toward the crossing from the U.S. side when it swerved to avoid another car, crashed into a fence, and exploded. All of a sudden, he went up in the air, and then it was a ball of fire like 30 or 40 feet high, Gunther told the station. I never saw anything like it. The Niagara Falls Bridge Commission called the incident a serious car crash. From inside Niagara Falls State Park, Melissa Raffalo said she saw a huge plume of black smoke rise up over the border crossing, about 50 yards away from the popular tourist destination. Raffalo told the AP in a message that police arrived soon after, urging visitors to disperse as they began cordoning off the street. Raghu Batare said by phone that he was inside his restaurant, the Niagara Tandoori Hut, near the bridge when he heard a sound he described as a boom. A few minutes later, he saw black smoke rising. The bridge and three others between Western New York and Ontario were quickly closed as a precaution, and the Buffalo-Niagara International Airport began security checks on all cars and told passengers to expect additional screenings. The safety measures tied up traffic at the airport and elsewhere on one of the busiest U.S. travel days of the year, before Thanksgiving. Trudeau said additional measures were being contemplated and activated at border crossings across Canada. In Toronto, about 100 miles away, police said they were increasing patrols as a precaution. New York City police were monitoring the news from Buffalo, but had boosted security at various spots because of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade on Thursday. The Niagara Falls Bridge Commission reported that all four of its crossings, the others are Lewiston, Whirlpool, and Peace Bridge, were closed. Sanchit Chatha, his wife Reshu, and their 13-year-old daughter Patricia had stopped in Niagara Falls for lunch en route home to Toronto from Buffalo when they started getting news notifications about the explosion. Worried friends called, knowing the family was in the area. Trisha was concerned at seeing the bridges to Canada shut down, her mother said. Canada, hard to eradicate super pigs threatening to invade U.S. by Steve Karnowski, The Associated Press, Minneapolis. An exploding population of hard-to-eradicate super pigs in Canada is threatening to spill south of the border, and northern states such as Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana are taking steps to stop the invasion. In Canada, the wild pigs roaming Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba pose a new threat. They are often crossbreeds that combine the survival skills of wild Eurasian boar with the size and high fertility of domestic swine to create a super pig that's spreading out of control. Ryan Brook, a professor at the University of Saskatchewan and one of Canada's leading authorities on the problem, calls feral swine the most invasive animal on the planet and an ecological train wreck. Pigs are not native to North America. Although they've roamed parts of the continent for centuries, Canada's problem dates only to the 1980s when it encouraged farmers to raise wild boar, Brooks said. The market collapsed after peaking in 2001, and some frustrated farmers simply cut their fences, setting the animals free. It turned out that the pigs were very good at surviving Canadian winters. Smart, adaptable, and furry, they eat anything, including crops and wildlife. They tear up land when they root for bugs and crops. They can spread devastating diseases, such as African swine fever, to hog farms. And they reproduce quickly. A sow can have 6 piglets in a litter and raise 2 litters in a year. That means 65% or more of a wild pig population could be killed every year, and it would still increase, Brooks said. Hunting just makes the problem worse, he said. The success rate for hunters is only about 2% to 3%, and several states have banned hunting because it makes the pigs more wary and nocturnal, tougher to track down and eradicate. Wild pigs cause about $2.5 billion in damage to U.S. crops every year, mostly in southern states such as Texas, and they can be aggressive towards humans. A woman in Texas was killed by wild pigs in 2019. Eradication of wild pigs is no longer possible in Manitoba and Saskatchewan, Brooks said. But the situation isn't hopeless everywhere, and a few U.S. states have eliminated them. The key, he said, is having a detection system that finds them early and fast, and then responding quickly. Brooke and his colleagues have documented 62,000 wild pig sightings in Canada. Their aerial surveys have spotted them on both sides of the Canada-North Dakota border. They've also recorded a sighting in Manitoba within 18 miles of Minnesota. Nobody should be surprised when pigs start walking across that border if they haven't already, Brooks said. The question is, what will be done about it? Brooks said Montana has been the most serious about keeping wild pigs out. It banned raising and transporting wild pigs within the state. The only path forward is you have to be really aggressive and you have to use all the tools in the toolbox, Brooks said. That could include some big ground traps with names like Boar Buster or net guns fired from helicopters. Some states and provinces embrace crowdsourced squeal-on-pigs tracking programs. Scientists have also studied poisons such as sodium nitrite, but they pose harming other species. Minnesota is among states trying to prevent the swine from taking hold. The state's Department of Natural Resources is expected to release a report in February identifying gaps in its management plan and recommend new prevention steps. Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is using aircraft and drones to beef up surveillance along the northern border. Minnesota was declared an eradicated state after USDA Wildlife Services shot and killed a group of pigs in 2016 that wandered off a farm and turned feral in the far northwest corner of the state, but not before they began to reproduce and root up a wildlife preserve. Gary Norenberg, the Minnesota Director of Wildlife Services, said as far as he knows, no truly wild pigs have made their way to his state yet. Feral swine have been reported in at least 35 states, according to the USDA. The agency estimates the swine population in those states totals around 6 million. In brief, Air Force base defends self from claims of political bias over conservative rally warning. The Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota is defending itself from claims of political bias after an unofficial message cautioning airmen to not attend a conservative political rally began circulating on social media. At issue is the Dakota Patriot Rally, an event held Friday in Minot featuring a pro-Trump group known as Turning Point Action. The group's founder is Charlie Kirk, a white conservative agitator who has built a following inflaming racial divides. For instance, scumbag is how he has described George Floyd, the black man whose murder at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer set off a global reckoning over racial injustice. A message that was reposted to a public Facebook page and was purported to be from base leadership described the group as an alt-right organization. It said that participation with groups such as Turning Point Action could jeopardize their continued service in the U.S. military. The outcry was immediate, with Republican U.S. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota and Kirk among those denouncing the message. The base responded Tuesday that the initial message was based on incorrect data and sent outside of official base messaging platforms. It said that it subsequently corrected the message traffic to categorize the event as a local political fundraiser and stressed that there was no issue with military members participating as long as they complied with regulations such as not wearing their uniforms. All Air Force airmen have a constitutional right to freedom of assembly, the Post said. But Cramer said in a news release Tuesday that a greater apology is needed. He said he spoke with General David Elvin, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, about what he described as a biased and misguided official communication. He said Elvin indicated that the base issued an internal correction within an hour. Why then, Cramer asked, did it take days for the base to issue a statement online? It's disgusting to me that anybody in our Air Force today would consider a Turning Point USA event anything other than a pro-American, patriotic, and frankly pro-military group, Cramer said. The Department of Defense already has drawn the ire of some conservatives. One flashpoint is new Pentagon rules that allow reimbursement for travel when a service member has to go out of state to get an abortion or other reproductive care. The policy led Senator Tommy Tuberville to block hundreds of military nominees. This brief was from the Associated Press. Children's Hospital, Colorado. More than 100 stepped forward to donate part of their livers. Every child in need of transplant will get one as donors clear wait list, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. So many Coloradans responded to a call to donate pieces of their livers that Children's Hospital Colorado expects every child in need of a transplant this year will get one. Hopefully, others will show the same generosity next year, since additional local children will get sick and kids in other parts of the country are still waiting for life-saving organs, said Dr. Amy Feldman, medical director of the liver transplant program at Children's Hospital Colorado. In early September, the hospital asked healthy adults to consider donating a section of their livers. 10 children were waiting at the time, and the University of Colorado Hospital hadn't recovered as many livers from deceased donors as in previous years. Some of the children were at risk of becoming too sick to undergo the surgery if organs didn't become available soon, meaning they would have been out of medical options. If we could have 10 people step forward and donate to these kids, that would be amazing, Dr. Megan Adams, Surgical Director of Pediatric Living Donor Transplantation at Children's, said at the time. More than 100 people stepped forward. Not all of them were healthy enough to donate or opted to continue as they learned more about the process, but 6 gave organs to children on the waiting list, and one more is already matched with the recipient and scheduled for surgery, Feldman said. 9 donors are still finishing the preparation process, so the 3 remaining children on the list will almost certainly get their transplants soon, she said. We have just been overwhelmed by the generosity of the Denver community, she said. University of Colorado Hospital committed to first offer livers from living donors to Children's, Feldman said. Transplants for kids involve a smaller piece of the liver than those for adults, making the recovery easier for the donor, she said. In adults, liver failure is typically caused by alcohol use, hepatitis viruses, or obesity, although some people's livers shut down because of excessive medication use or exposure to toxins. Most children who need transplants were born with malfunctioning livers, have diseases where the immune system attacks the organs, or have a metabolic condition that could be cured by a new liver. Donors go through 2 days of medical testing to make sure their own health won't be at risk during the surgery and recovery. All donors must be between 18 and 55 without obesity or other major health problems. For more information, visit uchealthlivingdonor.org. If all 9 of the waiting donors opt to go through with the surgery, some could give to children who aren't currently on the waiting list but are expected to be sick enough to qualify early next year, Feldman said. If Coloradans continued to donate at this rate, the hospital could offer transplant to kids in states that don't have pediatric liver donation programs that are set up for living donors, she said. In a typical year, about 10% of the infants and 5% of the older children waiting for donated livers nationwide die without receiving a transplant, Feldman said. That means 30 to 40 preventable deaths each year, plus the damage to kids' overall health from having liver failure while waiting for a transplant, she said. It's realistic to imagine a world where no child dies because of a lack of a liver graft, she said. Invasive species. Crawfish boils are now allowed in Colorado. Importation of Gulf Coast crustaceans will be legal starting January 1st, by Lee Schmelzer, the Denver Post. Gulf Coast crawfish are back on the menu in Colorado after state officials reversed a decades-long ban on importing the invasive crustaceans that was largely unheeded and unenforced. The Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission on Friday approved the importation of the red swamp crawfish for human consumption, although with some restrictions. Starting January 1st, people who want to bring the southern food staple into the state can do so with an importation license, but they cannot possess the crawfish for more than 72 hours or release them into water. Before the change, it was illegal to import or possess the species because of concerns that the crustaceans would damage lakes and rivers if they made their way into waterways. But the species remained easily available for purchase live or at restaurants. If caught, a violator was subject to a misdemeanor that could carry a fine of up to $5,000. Most of the people cooking and eating the mud bugs were unaware of the regulation banning them, and the ban went unenforced for years, Colorado Parks and Wildlife staffers said. There is a huge demand on these, Ty Petersburg, Assistant Chief of Law Enforcement Programs at the agency, told the commission at an August meeting. Consternation about the ban began in March when wildlife officials cited someone for importing the species, which led to a larger investigation into the industry. As a result of that case, CPW has been made aware of a significant culture in Colorado regarding social gatherings and meals surrounding crayfish boils, a Parks and Wildlife memo on the issue states. CPW law enforcement has now documented dozens of restaurants across the Front Range alone that hold regular crawfish boils and meal services with live imported crayfish. For years, Cajun restaurants sold imported crawfish, caterers put on boils for private events, and individuals bought live crawfish for backyard boils. One distributor told wildlife officials that they were selling 9,000 to 11,000 pounds of raw crawfish per week from January to August. If you extrapolate that, we have a whole lot of these critters coming into the state, something we didn't really realize, to be honest with you, Petersburg said. Despite the tons of crawfish coming into Colorado, the state has not detected a population in lakes or rivers here, said Josh Nehring, Assistant Aquatic Section Manager at Parks and Wildlife. However, the agency does not test specifically for the species. The species, if established, is capable of altering the habitat and food chain of lakes and streams, Nehring said. The ban was intended to keep the non-native species from being introduced to Colorado's waters if they were used as fishing bait or released live into the water. Red swamp crawfish are native to the Gulf of Mexico, but have established invasive populations in other states, including Minnesota, New Mexico, Maine, and Washington. If introduced into Colorado waters, the species could spread downstream to other states and communities. Several native species of crawfish live in the state east of the Continental Divide, but there are no native crawfish on the western side. Red swamp crayfish mature early and have rapid growth rates, large numbers of offspring, and short lifespans, a Parks and Wildlife memo states. They can replace indigenous crayfish by competitive exclusion and/or transmission of crayfish plague. A different invasive crayfish species, the rusty crayfish, is one of Colorado Wildlife Manager's top invasive concerns in the state. That crayfish has been found in Colorado's waterways since 2009, and wildlife managers believe they were introduced after anglers used them as bait. More than 200 people weighed in on the Gulf Coast crawfish issue during the agency's public comment process. About two-thirds of those who commented supported removing the ban. Some of those in favor of ending the ban noted that few people would pay $6 to $9 a pound for live crawfish simply to dump them in a river. The new regulation is an attempt to balance cultural and business needs with environmental risk, Petersburg said. Under the new rules, people who want to buy live crawfish and host their own boils must have a copy of the provider's importation license and a receipt of purchase, Colorado Parks and Wildlife spokesman Joey Livingston said. In brief, Jackson County. State reports that a wolf killed three lambs last week. Colorado Parks and Wildlife said it appears three lambs were killed by a wolf on a property in southern Jackson County. The deaths were reported by the ranchers Friday. The results of this investigation indicated wounds on the carcasses consistent with wolf depredation, area wildlife manager Chris Middledorf said. The field investigation found signs of hemorrhaging, indicating the attack occurred while the animals were still alive and the carcasses were not scavenged. The ranch is owned by Brian Anderson and his father, Philip. Philip is also the former president of the Colorado Cattlemen's Association. The wolf that killed the lambs is not a wolf from the state's reintroduction program. Wolves are not set to be released by Parks and Wildlife until December, after they are transported from Oregon. Parks and Wildlife has confirmed there are wolves in Colorado that migrated from Wyoming into Jackson County. This brief was from Sky High News. Visit state parks for free on 9th Fresh Air Friday. Thanksgiving marks the beginning of the busy winter holiday season, and Colorado Parks and Wildlife is inviting people to spend time outdoors Friday. Parks and Wildlife will offer free entry to all state parks on Fresh Air Friday. This year marks the 9th annual Fresh Air Friday. Visit the State Park Finder or use the free Colorado Trail Explorer mobile app to discover local parks, trail systems, and open spaces. Visitors should be aware that Friday is a state holiday, and some park visitor centers may not be open or fully staffed. Enforcement personnel will be patrolling the parks. This was from The Pilot and Today. Jefferson County. Missing dog discovered alive in mountains after nearly 2 months. Nova Riley found with a broken leg on a hiking trail north of Conifer. By Katie Langford, The Denver Post. A 14-month-old Bernese Mountain Dog that was missing for 7 weeks was found by hikers near a trail in western Jefferson County this week and reunited with her owner. Two hikers spotted Nova Riley near a trail in Meyer Ranch Park on Sunday, according to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office. The park is approximately 3 miles north of Conifer along U.S. 285. Nova Riley, a service dog in training to help her owner safely move around, was able to slip out of her harness and run away when she became spooked in a Safeway parking lot, her owner, Robin Simons Seely, said. Simons Seely, who is disabled, said community members and neighbors tirelessly helped her search for Nova Riley. The dog was spotted several times, but was too scared to come near people, Simons Seely said. She survived two snowstorms and below freezing weather, Simon Seely said. I was in tears every time it snowed. The hikers who found Nova Riley tried to befriend her when they didn't see her with any people, but she bit one of the hikers because she was injured and scared, the sheriff's office said in a post on Facebook. The hikers called for help, and one stayed with Nova Riley while the injured hiker met three open space rangers and animal control officer Kyle Roop at the trailhead. The hiker sustained only a minor injury and did not need stitches, Roop said. Roop and the rangers hiked 3 miles up the trail to rescue Nova Riley, who had a broken leg and was underweight, when a ranger recognized her from photos on a lost dog poster he had seen. Roop was able to earn the dog's trust quickly with food. When we first got up there, I had brought treats and food up with me, knowing she would probably be very food motivated at that point, Roop said. I used food to make friends, and she was very friendly, but skittish. Roop and the rangers were able to put Nova Riley on a tarp and carry her to the trailhead, where she was reunited with Simon Seeley. She was a little wary at first because it had been so long, but once she got some good sniffs, it was all happy barks and wiggly butts and very exciting, Roop said. Despite her injury and hunger, Nova Riley couldn't contain her excitement at seeing her person, Simon Seeley said. When I walked up to the car, it was like I was just another human being. And then she realized, and she went crazy, Simon Seeley said. It was so beautiful and so heartwarming, and the most wonderful sound of her realizing, I'm safe, I'm okay. Nova Riley was taken to an emergency vet and will need to have her broken leg amputated, Simon Seeley said. She lost about 20 pounds, or a quarter of her body weight, while she was missing. Nova Riley is starting to calm down but won't let Simon Seeley out of her sight. While Nova Riley can no longer work as a service dog, she's staying in her forever home with Simon Seeley, who said she is thankful for the hikers, county staffers, neighbors, and community members who worked to find and rescue Nova Riley and have donated to her medical expenses. I can't say enough about the kindness of people here, she said. Mars. CU finds answers about Martian atmosphere. MAVEN spacecraft reveals possibility life could have survived on Mars. By Olivia Doak, Prairie Mountain Media. Since its launch 10 years ago, a spacecraft carrying instruments built by the University of Colorado has made groundbreaking discoveries in unraveling the mystery of how the Martian atmosphere disappeared. Dried up river and lake beds on Mars indicate water used to exist there, potentially creating habitable conditions for life. However, the atmosphere on Mars is too thin today to sustain water on the planet, and scientists are trying to understand how that change happened. If we can understand that the atmosphere used to be thicker and that it definitely was capable of supporting liquid water at the surface, then we can understand that Mars might have been a place where life could have survived, CU scientist David Brain said. To understand how the atmosphere disappeared and where it went, the first mission devoted to studying the Martian upper atmosphere was launched on November 18, 2013, with MAVEN, or the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution spacecraft. The MAVEN mission is led by CU and continues to orbit Mars, transmitting data multiple times per day to a team at CU for collection and analysis. Graduate student Skylar Shaver is tasked with looking at the data, cleaning it up, and making sense of it. It can tell us a bit about how our planet may end up one day and what will happen if we lost our magnetic field or if there's a lot more activity from the sun, Shaver said. It also has implications for the next generation of human exploration. Shaver said sending humans to Mars requires more knowledge about its conditions. The changes in Mars's atmosphere also can relate to what's happening on Earth, she said. Understanding how the universe works and how the atmosphere can evolve over time is really important to understand, so we know what to look for with other forms of life in our universe and what we can expect to happen here if conditions change, Shaver said. The various observations MAVEN has collected led to the discovery that Mars's atmosphere has been stripped away by the sun and the solar wind over time, changing the climate from a warmer and wetter environment early in history to the cold, dry climate of today. The mission is approved and funded by NASA through September 2025, and NASA requires CU to submit proposals every few years to continue. As long as CU officials continue to make good progress and persuade NASA to continue funding it, the project will continue, Brain said. Scientists still have more questions they hope MAVEN can answer. Soon, the sun will approach solar maximum, a time in the sun's 11-year cycle when light and its processes become more intense and violent. Brain said the atmospheric escape on Mars may be more robust during this time. After the sun achieves solar maximum, scientists can go back 4 million years with their models because MAVEN will be able to collect information on the full range of conditions Mars experiences. MAVEN also may be able to collect information that would reveal the timing of the change in the Martian atmosphere to place tighter constraints on when and how it might have been habitable, Brain said. Continuing to study Mars may help scientists understand why Venus, Earth, and Mars are so different. The planets should have started similar to each other but look very different now, Brain said. And understanding how the atmosphere escapes to space at Mars could give knowledge to what might have happened over time to other planets. Thanksgiving. Travel rush off to a smooth start despite snowy forecast. By Deanne Durbin, The Associated Press. The late crush of holiday travelers picked up steam Wednesday, with about 2.7 million people expected to board flights and millions more planning to drive or take the train to Thanksgiving celebrations. Airline officials say they are confident they can avoid the kind of massive disruptions that have marred past holiday seasons, such as the meltdowns at Southwest Airlines over last Christmas. And as of midday Wednesday, that appeared to be the case. U.S. airports were reporting only 7 flight cancellations and 361 flight delays, according to FlightAware, a tracking service. Buffalo Niagara International Airport in New York said it was checking all vehicles arriving at the airport and performing additional security screenings after a car exploded at a nearby checkpoint on the U.S.-Canada border. But the airport remained fully operational. All 4 border crossings in the area were closed, the Niagara Falls Bridge Commission said. Snow showers could snarl traffic in other parts of the country. The National Weather Service was predicting accumulating snow in northern New England on Wednesday, including up to 8 inches of snowfall in northern Maine. Snow was also expected to hit the northern Rocky Mountains on Thanksgiving Day, bringing up to 1 foot of snow to parts of Wyoming by Friday. Security lines at airports could be long. Delta Airlines is telling passengers to arrive at the airport at least 2 hours before their flight if they are traveling within the United States, 3 hours early if they're flying overseas, and maybe earlier on Sunday and Monday. The Transportation Security Administration said it screened more than 2.6 million passengers Tuesday, and it expected another 2.7 million passengers to come through security on Wednesday. On Sunday, it expects to screen 2.9 million passengers, which would surpass a previous record set on June 30th. Lines ebbed and flowed all morning Wednesday at Moynihan Train Hall in New York. Some travelers said they opted to travel by train for convenience or lower prices. Others said they just wanted to avoid any chaos at the airport. Matthew Hudnall and Abby Greenbaum were traveling from Atlanta to New York to Boston to visit family with their 5-year-old daughter. By the time they reach Boston, they will have taken a total of 9 trains, they said. I think we thought it would be calmer and less stressful than flying. So far, that's true, Greenbaum said. Amtrak said it was expecting 750,000 passengers between November 19th and November 26th. The company said travelers could see some boarding delays this weekend because of high passenger volumes. The holiday will also test the Federal Aviation Administration, which faces shortages of air traffic controllers at key facilities that caused reductions in flights to the New York City area this summer and fall. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said during a news conference Monday that the government prepared for holiday travel by hiring more traffic controllers, opening new air routes along the East Coast, and providing grants to airports for snowplows and de-icing equipment. Airlines have also added tens of thousands of employees in the last couple of years, and Southwest says it bought more winter equipment to keep planes moving even during sub-freezing temperatures. AAA predicts that 55.4 million people will travel at least 50 miles from home between Wednesday and Sunday, the third highest forecast ever by the Auto Club. AAA says most of them, 49.1 million, will drive. Drivers will get a break from last year on gasoline prices. AAA says the national average for gas was down to $3.28 a gallon on Wednesday, compared with $3.63 a year ago. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.